Here we are, again, April 22nd, second half of our class in Mishnah and Talmud. We're in the second Mishnah, the third Perek. And I'll just mention that probably as time goes on, people start walking in for the briefs, we'll have to close the doors, and we'll have to really concentrate. People might be opening and closing them, so we'll have to be careful. Okay, here's the Mishnah. Mishnah Bet, Perek Gimel. Kavru et amet v'chazru. Im yicholim latchil v'ligmor ad shelo yagiu l'shura yatchilu. Im lav lo yatchilu. Hamdim l'shura hapnimim peturim v'chitzanim hayadim. Okay. So, let's try and understand the Mishnah. I guess you're looking for your Mishnah.
Looking for my pen or pencil. Either one. Started with both, and now I have none.
Okay, so the first question I asked was obvious. I'd let Chil Ligmor what? And of course, we're talking about Shema. We remember that even though the previous Mishnah did make some mention of Tefillah, the subject of our Perek is Kriyat Shema, and we're talking about Kriyat Shema. The second question is actually more interesting or complicated. The question was, do you think that the first part of this Mishnah is talking about the mourner or about the others at the funeral? Let's go one by one. Is it talking about the others or is it not talking about them?
It is.
It is. It's clearly talking about them, about people who are going to participate in being the shura. That's not the mourner, that is the Menachamim. The Menachamim means the comforters, doing the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim, of comforting.
How do you say Minach?
Nichum Avelim.
Menachamim.
I don't see that I have
Menachem it. Begin.
Yeah, write Menachem it on the board. Write it on the board over there.
Like Menachem Begin.
I'm looking for a marker, which I don't
Right there, Rabbi, in the shelf.
On the shelf.
In the glass.
Right there, Steve. Behind the glass. Open that up.
Okay.
Behind the glass.
So the mitzvah is Nichum Avelim, which is written like this. Nichum Avelim. And they are the Minachamim. Minachamim. They're doing the act of Nichum Avelim. Minachamim is what they are.
Is that comforting the mourners?
Comforting. They are the Minachamim. So clearly, the Minachamim are the ones we're talking about, at least. They're the ones concerning which we say that if they can start and finish before they get to the Shura, then they should, if not, they shouldn't. But the question is, what about the Avel himself? Is this Mishnah saying anything to him, or is it not? So on the one hand, you might say, of course it is.
Yeah.
If the Minachamim, you might think, are exempt from Shema, they're only supplementary to the Avel. He's the main character. If they're exempt, then all the more so, Kal v'chomer, is he exempt? So you might say. But it's not so. Paradoxically, it's not so. The Avel, from the time that he heard about the death until the burial, he was an Onein, in the period of Aninut. And the Onein is exempt, we learned from Kriyat Shema in the previous Mishnah. But that's only as long as Mishem Meito Mutal Lefanav. He has the obligation to bury. And the reason was because he has a mitzvah of burial. And he's tarud in the mitzvah, he's preoccupied. Once he's no longer no name, because the body is no longer Mutal Lefanav, it's been buried, the Avel is abagin or the mitzvot. We bring a minyan to his house, as we know, so he can do the mitzvah of Tzfilah b'minyan. In our Mishnah, there's really no indication of any discussion of the Avel. He has to say Kriyat Shema. The Menachamim might not have to say Kriyat Shema, as the Mishnah says. So the situation is like this. As soon as the body is covered up by earth, he's no longer an Onein. And if he hasn't said Kriyat Shema, and the time still is there to say Kriyat Shema, he'll say Kriyat Shema. Ah, that means other people have to wait for him. Their job is to wait for him. They are serving him. The menachemim are there to menachem him, to comfort him. They might be exempt from Shema because they have an obligation vis-a-vis him. But there's no reason for him to be exempt. So it's a funny situation. He's standing there saying Kriyat Shema, and all the others are running to Shura and trying to figure out if they can say Kriyat Shema by the time they get there or not. But he's in charge of the show. He's saying Kriyat Shema. And it makes sense because they're there to serve him, and he's not there to serve anyone. He has all the time in the world to say Kriyat Shema. Okay. And then it says exactly what times of day might the Mishnah be talking about, and that of course just ties our Mishnah into everything else we learned. We're talking about a time when there's an obligation to say Kriyat Shema. If we're talking about the morning, which we probably are, we know that the beginning time for saying Shema is the time of Mi Sheyavchin, when you can distinguish between blue and white, or blue and green. And according to the Tanakhama, which we learned months ago, you only have until when? Not Rabbi Yossi that gives you for 3 hours, but according to the Tanakhama, you only have until?
Sunrise.
Until, right, until Netzachama. Ha Netzachama. I made a mistake there. Ha Netzachama. You have about 25 minutes. And the funeral might have started early in the morning. And if you didn't say Shema beforehand, and you didn't say it when you were pulled there, it depends on everything we've learned. If you said the Shema already, of course, we're not talking about you. But if you haven't said it yet, and we're in that window of opportunity when it's time to say Shema, then you have to apply the Mishnah to yourself. It could also be talking about the evening Shema, but then there's much more time to say it, and these things would be less relevant. And according to, we have three different opinions, when you can say the evening Shema until the end of the first watch, or until midnight, or the whole morning, until the whole night time. So it probably applies to the morning Shema when the window of opportunity is very short.
Isn't that in the Shachas prayer? Shachas?
It's today, it's part of Shachrit. In those days, Shema and Tefillah were two separate entities. Yeah. Right, two separate sets of laws, two separate time frames.
With regard to this, David made an interesting point about does it apply to when you're at the end of the window?
Because, right, I heard you talking about that.
You know, if you're going to have a few hours anyway, or not, I guess depending with the morning, it's different, but you know, the same issue could apply in the evening.
Or in the morning, there's other opinions.
Right, or if you follow...
Or you have 3 or 4 hours.
Right, Rabbi Yossi says you have 3 hours.
So, are you, if you're exempt, are you exempt from the entire...
right.
You know, do you have, you're sort of get out of jail free, so to speak.
Right, the question is this about priorities of what you say first and what you do later, or is it about what you do and what you don't do? When it says exempt, does it mean exempt now, but you have to say it, you eventually have to say it,
right.
Or does it mean that if... You don't. It doesn't mean you don't say it now, and if the time passes, it passes. That's your question, right?
So, if it's related, I'll just add in. Actually, I was thinking of it in a slightly different way. If I have plenty of time after all this occurred, after the funeral's all done, I know I'll still have time after. Mm-hmm. Then maybe the mission isn't even talking to me at all.
Right.
Because I don't need to say it now, or is it saying a matter of priority, which you have to say first, even though you have lots of time? It's clear.
Right.
I mean, I guess it's
right.
Clear. It's talk. If you're about to run out of time, it's talking to you. That's clear, right or wrong, it's clear to me that if you're about to run out of time, it's talking to you. The mission's talking
to you. And you're right.
Okay.
You're right.
So, but if you have lots of time, you will have time after the funeral's all done. That's for sure. Is the Mishnah talking to you or not?
Right. So I think that in thinking about this, we're prejudiced by the halacha as we know it today. But if we go back to the Mishnah, we remember that the opinion of the Tanakhama was you have from the time you can see between blue and white or blue and green until the sun comes up, period. There was a minority opinion of Rabbi Yossi, you have 3 hours, and we accept that today. But it appears to me that the Mishnah is based upon the halacha of the Tanakhama. You only have 20 minutes, so it's not relevant what you're asking.
I understand. Okay.
It's a question of, I have to do it now or I miss it. And when it says patur, it means you miss Kriyat Shema.
Okay.
So the next question I formulated for classes that didn't use the Arabic version, that is punctuated, which makes it easier, but let's just at least understand how difficult it would be to understand the Mishnah without punctuation. The manuscripts don't have punctuation. More, by and large, most of them don't have punctuation, and of course don't have vowels. All it said, I'm going to read the second half of the Mishnah, was, Omdim b'shura, pnimim p'torim v'achitzonim chayvim. You have to figure out that Omdim b'shura, colon, Omdim b'shura, hyphen. Right? It's shorthand. It could have said, concerning the Omdim b'shura, it might have made it easier for it. The Mishnah doesn't make it easier for you. It uses concise language.
But why would it have been confusing with that? Because Omdim b'shura, pnimim, you know you're not talking about the
shura. You might have tried to read it, Omdim b'shura pnimim.
But shura, you wouldn't say pnimim.
Right, right, you'd figure it out, but you would probably struggle for five or ten minutes.
It's nice to have punctuation. Yeah. Final punctuation.
Then the truth is, once you have the punctuation, it's hard to imagine how hard it would have been without it. I think it's hard to work backwards. But it doesn't matter. Question 5. When the Mishnah talks about Homdim B'Shura, is it referring to those who are earlier able at Chil Gmor? Not, we just discussed that. Obviously, if you already said Shema, it's not discussing you. It's discussing those that couldn't do it earlier at all, either because the time hadn't come yet or because they didn't have time to begin and end before they got to Shura, so they're waiting to say Kriyat Shema. There are 5 minutes left, there are 4 minutes left, 3 minutes left, and what do I do? I have a conflict between two mitzvot, one Nichum Lavilim and the other Kriyat Shema. What do I do? So here's the law. Pnimim Peturim and Mechitzonim Chayavim. Right. So in question 6, I asked the question we talked about, what mitzvah is fulfilled in the Shura? It is Nichum Avilim, of course. But look at the next question, which starts us thinking. How is this mitzvah, the one of Nichum Avilim, fundamentally different from the mitzvah under discussion in the previous Mishnah? What was the mitzvah in the previous Mishnah?
It's dealing with a different object of attention.
Right, exactly. First, and what was the object of attention there?
First Mishnah dealt with the burial of the deceased.
Right, the mate. The question is, who is the source of our patur? Is it the living or the dead? In the previous Mishnah, the dead was the source of our patur. We were honoring the dead. We were involved in kavod hamet as the general rubric and umbrella, and more specifically, livayat hamet, accompanying the dead. If we're talking about the pallbearers, and if we're talking about the mourner himself, we're talking the mitzvah of kivurat hamet, of burying the dead. But it's all about the dead, and all the focus is on the dead, and the source of the patur is the dead. Whereas in our Mishnah, we're switching. It's a very clear switch, and it's very important. We're switching from the dead to the living. We're now no longer honoring the dead. We're rather honoring the living, the avel. Right, and that happens at the moment of kvura. Make it clear, even, there's no mitzvah to comfort the mourner when he's onen. Mm-hmm. Right? You have no obligation towards him, and you actually stay away from him. Right, he's mentioned, right? You stay away from him. It's his time.
Right.
And even though there might be a natural, of course it makes you feel very uncomfortable, and it might be a natural desire to hug and to comfort, there's no mitzvah to give any attention to the onen while he still has meitom utalifanav. The body is buried, the focus switches from the meit to the chai, to the living. Okay. So, 8, we said, what is the halachic principles that behind the exemption of the Shema that we find in this Mishnah? We've said this many, many times in many, many Mishnayot, right? I, as a Menachem, have a mitzvah of Nichum Avilim, and Osek b'mitzvah patur min a mitzvah, so I have reason to think that I'm going to be exempt from Shema. Reason to believe. We'll have to discuss, are you or are you not?
Does the issue of concentration play in this at all? Because if I'm here in line and you're down here, or the mourner is down here, rather, why not just get started and with Shema and then interrupt like we, you know, with the connection that you ask about later to the to meeting somebody.
Right.
So do you need to pay attention what we're talking about to the fact that you're going to have to give this greeting to somebody who's coming up versus just are you preoccupied in addition to being involved in a mitzvah?
I don't think it's preoccupation of the type we've been talking about that is an extension of a sacred mitzvah. It's just a cold calculation of will I finish or will I not. It's not that I'm involved in thinking of...
Well, I've got to pay attention to when he's walking by me. Granted, it's not as compelling as...
It's not as compelling. I don't know. I don't know. In the Mishnah about greeting your fellow during Shema, we were never told that you begin Shema knowing you'll have to interrupt. Rather, if you're already saying it and you have to interrupt, you have to interrupt. Here, we're telling you, don't start saying it if you know you'll have to interrupt. I think that distinction makes some sense, I think. So anyway, again, it's a sacred mitzvah for Torah mitzvah, like we've seen many, 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 many times. Sacred mitzvah. Patur min mitzvah. On the other hand, of course, we remember that Shema is belechtecha bederech. We try and do two things at once. We try and say Shema while we're involved in the community. We don't put aside the community for Shema, and we usually try and do both at the same time. If we have to put one aside for the other, so we say osek b'mitzvah patur min mitzvah, and Shema is put aside for the needs of the community. That was the model, of course, with the Rabban Gamliel, let's not say Rabban Gamliel, with the one who gets married, he's osek b'mitzvah, tarud b'mitzvah, he doesn't say Shema because he's involved in the community. The same thing could be here. Okay. 10. To what law in the previous Mishnah is the law of the Chitzonim and the Pnimim parallel?
I would guess it has to be the Nosei Amitah.
Yeah, and you're right. But now, which Nosei Amitah are like the Pnimiim and which are like the Chitzoniim?
The ones who are the ones that are needed and the ones who are not needed.
Yeah, that's a nice parallel, and it's really true. The question is always, to what degree are you connected? Are you needed for the object, for the mitzvah object you're involved in? The previous Mishnah was for the dead, and our Mishnah is for the living, but the question is how much do the dead need you, how much do the living need you, and we're weighing. Tzorach bem, not tzorach bem, is pnimim and chitzonim, more or less. More or less. Yeah. So then, I had my kind of quirky question 11. How could the distinction found in the second half of the Mishnah between the Pnimim and the Chitzonim have been applied to the first half of the Mishnah as well? So, I'm not changing my own point, what I said to you, I'm just going to phrase it differently. I see how I have it in my notes, right? We could have said that those who will be Chitzonim should say the Shema even if they cannot let Chiyuv Ligmor. Because let's think. There's two situations. One is walking to the Shura, the other is being in the Shura. Which one of them is directly for the Avel? Obviously the Shura itself. The walking there is just a means, just getting there. So the question is, what's the hierarchy of values in the Shura? So the hierarchy of values, we said, is that if you're in the Chitzoni, which means in a certain sense there's no Tzorech for you, in the direct sense.
They don't need you.
They don't need you. So you have to say Shema when you're in the Shura. You have to say Shema when you're in the Shura, and then all the more so you have to say it when you're walking to the Shura. Right? The object of the whole exemption is only the Shura itself. If you're going to be exempt in the Shura, so you might be exempt while you're walking there. If you're not going to be exempt in the Shura, why should you be exempt while you're walking there? It doesn't make any sense. So therefore, the whole thing about if you can say it while you're walking, then you're obligated. If you can't, you're not. That only should apply to those who then get to the Shura Pnimit. If you're going to be in the Shura Chitzunit, then of course you're obligated. There's no basis not to be obligated. So either we say that this is all true, and the matter of if you can start and finish when you're walking only applies to those who will be in the Shorah Pnimit. Makes a lot of sense. Or we'll say you just don't know who's going to be in the Chitzonit or the Pnimit. And of course that gets to the question of, is it coincidental who's in the Shorah Chitzonit to Pnimit, or is it something that's based on your degree of connection to the mourner? And if it's based on your degree of connection to the mourner, you already know more or less where you're going to be, and therefore if you're not going to be in the Chitzoni, then you're already finished. The mourner's finished with you, so say Shema before the Shorah while you're walking. And that might be the case. Yeah. Okay. Question 12, simply, why isn't it written there? Either because it's assumed or because it's not true because you don't know who's going to be in the Chitzonim and the Pnimi. Yeah. So now let's just finish up with 13 and 14. I mean, finish up with the Mishnah. We still have the Tosefta to look at. So question 13 was to take note of parallel themes. And I really think it deepens our understanding to take time to think about how these themes are repeating themselves again and again and again. So, I'm thinking about the Shorah. So in the Shorah, you have an obligation towards the Avel. You're Menachem Avelim, you're involved in the community. And it's so much like, as we mentioned, so much like saying Shema and someone walks into the Beit Knesset, the first Mishnah of the previous chapter. Do you say hello or not? And the answer is more or less related to how much of a need is there for you to say hello. Kavod, Yirah. Because we really want to make an effort to not destroy community connections because of Shema. Because the whole meaning of Shema is Belech Techa B'Derech, is part of the community. I also think about the picking fruit or the building the wall on the top of the tree. And we said you're involved in the community and you try and say the Shema while you're there, while you're on top of the tree, while you're building the wall, right? That was what the Mishnah said. Same thing here. You say Shema while you're walking to the Shorah if it will work. But remember, we saw in the Tosefta on the Mishnah about picking fruit and about the wall, and the Tosefta also brought the porter with that refrigerator on his back. It said that he says Shema while he's walking with the refrigerator in his back, but he doesn't say Shema while he's putting it on or taking it off, because that's too much of a conflict of intention, of Kavanah. So the same thing here. You could say it while you're walking, right? But you can't say it while you're actually involved in the Shorah and talking to the Avel. Mm-hmm. It's all a matter of weighing the different...
You cannot do two mitzvahs together. You
can't do two things at the same time. You can walk with your refrigerator on your back and say Shema, but you can't put it on and off, just like you can't talk to the Avel while you're also saying Shema.
The same thing with the Chosen.
Same thing there.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So these themes seem to be repeating themselves. Yeah. So now we get to something complicated. Question 14 and 15. What central patur found in the previous Mishnah is completely missing from this one?
That's the tefillah.
Yeah. Very good. The tefillah. And then I asked, well, why isn't it mentioned? And it's kind of hard to know. Are you exempt or you're not exempt from tefillah? So I could say, going back to the previous chapter...
Can I just ask, are you sure it's not mentioned?
So tell me what you mean.
The Shema is not mentioned. It doesn't say what it's talking about.
Right. So that's what I said earlier, that if it doesn't say what it's talking about, since the Perek is about Kriyat Shema, it's certainly talking about Shema. And look, as far as the first part of the Mishnah says, if you can begin and end before you get to the Shorah, it sounds like you're walking and saying Shema. So you certainly couldn't be doing Tefillah and walking, I think. So what's the situation here with tefillah? Either there's an exemption, it's not mentioned, or there's no exemption. Perhaps there's no exemption. Perhaps in order to be involved in the community, to be Menachem Avilim, we don't exempt you from tefillah. Because remember, tefillah is something separate from community. It's not about talking to man. It's not about creating community. It's not about declaration of community loyalty. It's a separate thing that separates from the community. You approach God. If you're involved with your friends, that's not no reason to be exempt from tefillah. The previous Mishnah exempted you from tefillah because there your obligation wasn't vis-a-vis human beings, it was vis-a-vis the dead. And that's perhaps something different. For being involved with human activity, then we exempt you from Shema, but not from tefillah. As far as kavod hamet, that might be different. That might be different.
We picture this process that we just are reading, this current Mishnah, of being in the cemetery, and therefore maybe I'm thinking you're not allowed to say tefillah in the cemetery. Is that right?
Well, the same thing would apply to Kriyat Shema.
Is that right?
Okay, the truth is, I don't know, but it doesn't matter because you're thinking of a cemetery, a formal place where there are lots of graves. Here, I don't know where they're burying the person. No.
Well,
in any case,
to say Kaddish at the cemetery.
Yeah. Right. So I don't know. But the fact, what the law is at a later period, of course, doesn't necessarily tell us anything about what's happening in the Mishnah.
But they didn't say. I thought at the time of the Mishnah, or at least the Gemara, you weren't allowed to say. You weren't allowed to daven in the cemetery.
So you're talking about the Gemara, but the strange things in this parak.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you allowed to say Tehillim at the cemetery?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. So
yeah.
Things you can say at the cemetery.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Kaddish you can say at the cemetery.
Correct.
Kaddish, Tehillim.
Right.
We don't know whether you can daven.
So you're saying that, as far as you know, you can't daven.
I'm saying
within
that's my
four,
impression.
Within four amot of a grave. Okay.
Where does that come from?
From the third parak in the Gemara here.
It's in the Gemara.
It's in the Gemara, and also I haven't ever seen anybody do that. I've seen people say Kaddish. I've seen people say Tehillim. I've never seen anybody.
Is it being a cemetery or a dead body being nearby?
Well. That's what I mean. Within four amot of a dead body. That's what I mean when you say a cemetery. Within four cubits, handbreadths of a dead body. Okay, let's take a little time to look at the Tosefta, which gives us some information and clarifies some things and makes other things more complicated.
Tosefta Brochos.
Yeah. So I put a set of Tosefta.
Where do I have this?
And I just wanted to take a minute to show you. These are two volumes of a 25-volume set. So first I'll show you the Tosefta. This is volume Zraim, right, 1/6 of the Mishnah. And I probably have mentioned in the past that around Professor Shaul Lieberman was one of the greatest, academic Talmidei Chachamim of the previous generation. He passed away about 25 years ago, and he devoted his life to editing the Tosefta. Since the Tosefta was rarely learned, in the course of 1,500 years of Galut, rarely doesn't mean not at all, but it wasn't learned like the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Rishonim were learned. It was rarely learned and rarely copied. We have few manuscripts that some of them were quite corrupt, and we didn't have a continuous tradition of how to learn it, because it wasn't often learned. And the addition of the Tosefta that people usually learned from when they learned Tosefta is printed in the back of every Masechet of the Gemara, back of Brachot, you have Tosefta Brachot, back of Nidah, you have the Tosefta of Nidah. That one is from a very corrupt manuscript, and it's very, very problematic to read from. There's a lot of problematic Yersot there. So he devoted his life to putting out a clear version of Tosefta. He collected manuscripts from around the world and put out these six volumes, and they're considered to be I shouldn't say six because he didn't complete it before his death. I don't know if there's four or five. So this is considered to be the really only edition that can be relied on, even though it's published by Beit HaMidrash LeRabbanim BaAmerika, which in English is
Jewish Theological Seminary.
The rumor goes, I've never checked it out, that even in Yeshiva Panovich, they have one set of books from JTS, which is the Tosefta. If it's true or not...
Are they only mentioned in Talmud Yerushalmi or Talmud Bavli?
Throughout the Bavli. Many Braitot that appear in the Tosefta are also brought in the Bavli. And then he put out a commentary on the Mishnah, and that's called the Tosefta Kipshuta. This one is just on Brachot and Trumot, on the Masechtot from Brachot to Trumot, which is about five Masechtot. He put out about 20 volumes of these, and there's nothing like it in the world. He just knew everything, and every possible Rishon reading to the Sefta, any possible Girsa, any possible Midrash, it's all brought here. There are pages and pages on each line of the Tosefta, and it's considered to be the ultimate. He didn't finish it before his death, and no one in the past 25 years has arisen that has the ability to follow in his footsteps. So anyway, I photostat it from Professor Lieberman's Tosefta here, and I photostat it from his commentary over here. So the Tosefta on our Mishnah is in Perek Bet, and not in Perek Gimel, Brachot. And it says, Kavru et amet vamdu b'shua. Shua hapnimit pitura, hahitzona hayevit. Which is exactly like our Mishnah. It's not word for word, but it's the exact same idea. If you follow with your finger the Tosefta and the Mishnah says, Amdim b'shura, whereas the Tosefta says, Kavru et amet v'amdu b'shura. Same thing. And the Tosefta says, Shura pnimit pitura. And the Mishnah says, Hapnimim piturim. Same thing. And the Tosefta says, Ahitzona hayevit. The Mishnah says, Ahitzonim hayevim. So that's fine. That's beautiful. We see the Tosefta and the Mishnah are parallel, which means, of course, that the Tosefta is codifying a Braita that existed for hundreds of years, and the Mishnah took from that Braita to create the concise code of Jewish law, the Mishnah. But then it gets more interesting, and it says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Im ein sham ela shura echat, Haumdim l'shem kavod hayavin l'shem evel piturim. Says Rabbi Yehuda, if there isn't there anything but one shura, and by the way, one shura means two shurot, one on each side.
Together, they're all together.
They're all together, but one on each side, not two on each side.
Uh-huh.
There's no pnimi and chitzoni. So Rabbi Yehuda says, "Im ein sham ela shura achat." If there's nothing but one shura, haumdim l'shem kavod chayavin. Those who are there for the sake of honor are obligated. L'shem evel piturin. Those who are there for the sake of mourning are exempt. So, think of just one shura on either side. Some people are going to be saying Shema Kriyat Yehuda. Some aren't. What's the difference? Why they're there. But what does it mean? Those who are there for the sake of honor and those who are there for the sake of evil. So Professor Lieberman says, and it seems to make sense, those who are there only to honor the avel, but they're not part of his pain, they're obligated. But those who are part of his pain, they're for the sake of avel, they're participating in the avilut, they're exempt. So Rabbi Yehuda is trying to take the distinction of inner and outer, pituin, chitzonim v'pinimim, and assimilate it into a situation of one shura, just like when you have two shurot, so the inner one, those more connected to the events, they're feeling the avel, the evil, excuse me, they're exempt. Those in the second shura are only there for honor, they're only there to add honor, so they are obligated. And then Rabbi says, what if there's only one shura? Try and make the same distinction in one shura. So here I have a question I have no answer to. Why? Why not just say, if there's one shura, so everyone is exempt? Because the Evil is seeing all of them, he's facing all of them, he needs their help, he needs their support. Rabbi Yehuda, for a reason I don't know, want someone saying Shema. I don't know why. And I understand the distinction between those who are there for the sake of honor, those who are there for the same sake of evil.
It's trying to distinguish between, rather than dealing with the mourner as being the object of the Mishnah, it's including the mourner.
Why including the mourner?
It was saying that those who are mourning are obligated.
Yeah, but I think it's not
they're exempt
because they're mourning. It's because they're participating in the mourning of the Avel, and therefore they're closer to him, their mourner's wavelength. He needs them more.
Uh-huh.
But why there has to be... I guess Rabbi Yehuda knows there are people at a funeral that really aren't fully part of the Avilut, and therefore they can't be exempt from Shema. And if they happen to find, they're the type of people who would gravitate to the outer line. If there's no outer line, there's not enough people there, they're going to be in the inner line, because still, there's not enough of a connection there, not enough of Tzorach Behem for them to be exempt. Even if they're going to see the face of the Avel as he passes by, but he's not connected to them enough for that connection to override Kriyat Shema.
Maybe the situation where the person didn't have family members, wasn't well known, was a stranger to the community.
Yeah.
And there are people who were asked to come to make a minyan.
Right.
And didn't know the deceased.
Yeah, and then what happens if everyone in the shore is going to say Shema, because they're all only L'shem Kavod. That's really a bizayon. That's kind of... No. So notice, this is in Rabbi Huda's name. Obviously, there is a machloket. Some would say that if there's only one shura and they're all facing the avel, they all are exempt from Shema. Rabbi Huda says no. Yeah.
What is the bigger mitzvah, L'shem Kavod or L'shem Ovel? The mitzvah, which one is bigger?
Well, there's more of Nichum Avelim when you're there, L'shem Avel, when you're feeling the pain.
It's a big mitzvah, yeah.
Feeling the pain.
L'shem Kovot is not such a big mitzvah.
You're participating in the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim, but not in a direct, emotionally connecting fashion. So the next part of the Tosefta is extremely interesting and becomes problematic. We'll do what we can. It says, Yardu Lehespet. They went down to the Hespet. Haroim et apanim pituim. Those who see the face are exempt. She'in ruim et apanim chayvim. And those who don't see the face are obligated. So, if we read this as a continuation of the previous line, it means the body has already been buried. And then they're going down to the Hespet, to the eulogy. Now that's strange, because as far as we know, eulogies are done before the burial and not after. Right? So this is difficult for the commentators. But if we read it as it's written, it says that they buried and then they went down to Hespet. Perhaps there was a custom of doing Hespedim after the burial. But again, this becomes difficult. And it says, Haroim et apanim peturim. Those who see the face are exempt. Well, that seems to continue with the matter of the chitzoni and the penimi, and what Rabbi Yehuda said, L'shem Avel, L'shem Kavod, you're sitting in the Hesped, and those who see the face, which would mean see the face of the Avel, and so the Avel feels a connection to them, so they're exempt from Shema. But those who don't see the panim of the Avel are obligated. Sitting in the back rows, it's kind of analogous to the back row of the Shura, so they are obligated in Shema. So it could make sense, except for the possibility of who heard of a Hesped after the burial. But then the next line is totally problematic. Hasofed v'chol ha'asukim behesped, the eulogizer,
That's
Hasofed. The eulogizer. V'chol asukin behesped, and all those who are participating in the hesped, in the eulogy, mafsikin lekriyat shema. They stop for kriyat shema. That's off the wall. You just told me that in a shura and in the hesped, those who are sitting up front, those who are connected, are exempt from Shema. And now you're telling me that the whole project of saying the Hesped stops to say Kriyat Shema. You just contradicted yourself. You hear the contradiction? So mafsikim the Kriyat Shema, they ain't mafsikim the Tefillah, but for Tefillah, they don't stop.
Yeah.
Which seems to mean that you're exempt from Tefillah. And then it says another opinion. Ma'aseh shivsiku rabutinu lekriyat shema v'letfilah. And it happened once upon a time that a rabbi stopped for shema and for tefillah. The whole machloket is you stop for tefillah or not, but everyone agrees you stop for kriyat shema. But why stop for kriyat shema? You've just been telling us all this time that you miss kriyat shema, you patur mi kriyat shema when you're close to the avel. Now you're telling me that the whole process itself stops. So everyone can say Shema, so it is very difficult. And we'll just see that the Yerushalmi picks up on this difficulty and has something to say about it. So at the bottom of the page...
If you assume that all of this is after the burial, then your questions are not quite so severe.
Are not quite severe after the burial.
Right, because all that we've read has to do with before the burial and then the line immediately after. And so if now you've gone through the line and now you're going back to the house for a eulogy, if that's the system, then your challenges to this of saying, you just told us to chayav and putter and all the rules of no, we didn't. It's a different circumstance.
That's what Yerushalmi says, basically. Very good. You're the Talmud Yerushalmi. Could be. Well, let's lead the Yerushalmi. David just told us more or less what it says. The Yerushalmi says, Tani, we learned in a Braita, HaHesped, in our text it was the HaSofed, HaHesped, the eulogy, which doesn't make any sense, the Kol Oskim BeHesped, and all those connected to the Hesped, occupied in it, mafsikin lekriyat shema ve'ein mafsikin letfilah. That's what our Tosafta said. They stop for kriyat shema, don't stop for tefillah. Masei haya, once upon a time, v'fsiku rabutinu lekriyat shema letfilah. And our rabbi stopped for tefillah and for kriyat shema. They stopped for them both. In other words, one opinion says that you stop for tefillah, one that doesn't, but they all agree that you stop for shema. And that bothered me, right? And so the Yerushalmi is also bothered. And it says, "V'ha tanein," and behold, we learn in a Mishnah, "Im yecholim v'latchir v'ligmor." We learned in our Mishnah, if you can begin and end, etc. So it doesn't finish the thought, but it's the same thing we said earlier. In other words, the Tosefta says you stop the whole eulogy thing for Shema, meaning you're not exempt from Shema, you have to say Shema, whereas the beginning of the Tosefta said that for the Shura, you're exempt, and the Mishnah also said it. The Mishnah said you're exempt, and only if you can say Shema before the Shura begins do you do it. So the Mishnah and the Tosefta say that you're exempt from Shema for the eulogy, whereas the second part of the Tosefta says that the eulogy has to stop for Shema. That's a contradiction. And the answer is basically what David said. And what it says is as follows. Matnita biyom harishon. Our Mishnah, it says with the Shura stuff that you're exempt from Shema because of the Shura, that's biyom harishon. That's on the first day. That's right when you just finished the burial. Umadatani tana biyom ashrini. But that which the author of the Tosefta said, that's later. Literally, biyom ashrini, the next day. So David said it's a few hours later. It's the same idea. It's later, and therefore there's less of a urgency to be with the Avel every minute, so you can stop for a Kriyat Shema. It still doesn't make too much sense, the truth is, because if you can stop for Shema, why do you not stop for Tefillah? If it's the second day already, it's much, much later, and there's not that much urgency, so you make everyone say Shema, then why don't you say Tefillah? But that's left unanswered, and Professor Lieberman is perturbed, and he goes through it.
So these issues are trying to distinguish, so these Brysons are trying to distinguish between the first day, where there may be elements that warrant exemption, and the second day, where there are no reasons to be exempt.
Vis-a-vis Shema. But Tefillah throws a monkey wrench in it, that it says where we, it says, Ein mafzikim l'tefillah. It says we don't stop for Tefillah, which means we're going to let the time of Tefillah go. We're going to be exempt from Tefillah.
But my question then is, if the Avel is not exempt after the first day, after the burial, why would those who are comforting him
be exempt? Because that's explainable. That we said that the Avel is obligated all the mitzvot, but the Menachemim, the comforters, they have an obligation towards him.
Right, but in order for him to do his mitzvah of Kriya Shema, well, of course that's Blech Kavaderech, but also in Tefillah, I mean, he needs a minion.
Right, he needs a minion
to participate with him, and so he can do his avodah and his mitzvahs. You need to participate with him and also say Kriya Shema and Tefillah.
Right. Yeah, that's basically another way of saying the question I was saying. That's why is the no? Why is there, why do we say that there's an exemption from Tefillah? How could there be an exemption from Tefillah? For what? We don't stop the eulogy for Tefillah. I mean, it usually goes on, even though the time of Tefillah has come and is going. So we'll end with a question. Okay, so I think it's good to try and find time at home to put everything together, to see the themes as they develop.